We will open up the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Remind folks of the cell phone. I don't know if prohibition is the right word. It throws our microphones off, and they were off yesterday. So we're continuing on the debt and the bonding program for higher ed and community colleges. And we had some questions after Laura Lockwood McCall and Mr. Kinney yesterday on the debt management policy board. And we have our Senate representative, Senator Metzger, and Mr. Kinney here to at least walk us through, and this is short notice, so we obviously won't hold them to much, but just the process that board uses to give their recommendation to the governor and the legislature in terms of proper levels of debt. So Senator Metzger and Mr. Kinney would be willing to come up, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 152. And thank Mr. Kinney and Senator Metzger for helping us better understand the Debt Management Policy Committee.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and I serve on the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee. It's actually my second stint. About 4 years ago, I was a Senate member and was reappointed to that position a year ago. And I know you've had probably lots of information about the state debt policy role. I'll just give you a brief synopsis of what I see from a legislative standpoint. Obviously, the commission was established with the goal of being able to help advise policymakers, vis-a-vis us, in terms of, you know, what is prudent use of debt, of state funds, tax-supported debt. We have a number of different avenues in which we use that, our general fund obligation debt, transportation debt, which is separate but still, you know, tax-supported debt, our lottery debt. And part of this is to get a framework, I think, to bring back to our colleagues, Representative Butler is the House member on this committee, as to what is the prudent range of debt. And one of the things the Commission has done over the last number of years is to expand the look at debt more broadly than just biennium to biennium, which is what we do with our own budgeting. And what the Commission tries to do is to look at debt generally in a six-year phase. So we look at what is our capacity over the next 6 years, not just by a biennia, and then what is prudent. Because one of the things, as you know, Mr. Chair, we hear a lot about, well, we could issue up to X amount of debt. Well, just because you have the capacity to do that doesn't necessarily mean that it's prudent. And so we try to look at, for advice to our colleagues, is what was prudent debt, try to maintain our 5% level maximum with the general fund. We have a 4x ratio we use with lottery. Again, transportation dollars are different because they are restricted only for use of the highway, but they still obviously are tax-supported debt, and they do restrain, you know, future utilization of those dollars. And so I think our real goal is to be able to be some kind of a governor on the amount of debt that we're going to utilize for a number of reasons. Number one, just to be prudent so that we don't overstep any one biennium. Secondly, is to maintain our bond rating for our debt so that we maintain flexibility, elasticity for unexpected expenditures that we may want to use that debt capacity for. And to make sure then that not only are we within the range, that we don't keep pushing up to it, which takes away our flexibility as legislators to address issues like, well, what you're doing right now, Mr. Chair, with colleges and infrastructure, or what Senator Starr and I worked on a couple sessions before with OTIA, with the transportation dollars, and making sure that when prudent investment, utilizing the ability to bond some of our revenues, that that flexibility is there and it's prudently used.
Questions for Senator Metzger. So this is somewhat of an arcane question. How is, we saw that yesterday, we saw the members, yourself and Representative Butler and Laura Lockwood McCall, the state treasurer, and I think Wes Lawrence from KeyBank. How is your commission or board staffed? When they bring recommendations, or we see your recommendations in terms of proper levels of debt, is it a team within the Treasury that brings those recommendations, and then you scrub them as a board?
Treasury staff is a real driving force to providing the data and make it meaningful for the commission. We start with getting a draft report that staff has prepared, and then we go through that that draft report in terms of tweaking the recommendations of what do these numbers actually mean as we move into session as to what is going to be a proper recommendation for the legislature. And again, keeping in mind, just because we have debt capacity doesn't mean we have to use it. But I think it's really, really an important part of the policy part, taking the numbers that are embedded in the document and being able to look at what is a prudent use of each of our tax-supported debt possibilities for bonding. And Treasury is just as yeoman's work in putting that together, updating that, looking at the assumptions from the previous biennia, looking at the projections that Mr. Warner and others provide in terms of state revenue, so we know what is the elasticity of our possible bonding over the next biennia, adjusting those numbers accordingly, testing those, and then bringing them before the commission.
And this may be a Mr. Kinney question. So one of the things that came up yesterday was, and this is something we're so well aware of, is the volatility of forecasts because of the income tax. How is that incorporated into when you make your recommendations to us and to the governor of proper levels of bonding? How is that forecasting, and I guess what are the trade-offs with you have one forecast and two, three forecasts later it's changed significantly, which obviously Oregon's in a precarious position as compared to other states where they don't just have that volatility that they're trying to deal with. And how does this commission deal with the 9-month swing that we just saw, or the 12-month swing where revenues were here and then they're here?
Well, I'll just touch it first and then I might give some more detail. Part of the thing that you'll see in the report is a recognition of the volatility of our income tax, particularly for the general tax-obligated bonds. And there's some modeling that is done there based on what happens if our revenue forecast is off, like, say, by 10%, and how that changes our capacity, which then results into the policy recommendation that even though we have so much capacity, and again, going back to the six-year look, the three biennia as opposed to one biennia, recommending fragmented utilization of that capacity, not front-loading that in the immediate biennia, so that if we have a drop in revenue revenues, then a 10% say drop can significantly change what is going to be our capacity and could put us in trouble with our rating agencies right away. And so that's one of the reasons that the Policy Commission, you know, recommends a more moderate investment, you know, in say the immediate biennia and the next biennia, and be able to, if we're going to use this capacity up, to do it in a prudent way and don't front load that with large dollars to try to avoid having that problem in which we go over our target capacity. Is that accurate?
Yes. Chair Decker, member of the committee, Senator Metzger has hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly right. And in addition to that, the Treasurer has the ability to not approve any bond sale that might take place during the course of the biennium if circumstances should change dramatically. So there's that additional control that also is there. So in addition to the dividing the debt capacity in six-year level increments to, if you will, absorb any fluctuations in the short term, we also have that ability. The Treasurer has the ability to control bond sales. And the governor's budget as well recognizes those 10% volatility, at least on the low side. So the governor's budget does not go all the way, as you mentioned yesterday, all the way up to the 5% limit, but actually leaves some room there. So hopefully if there were a downturn temporarily, it would come back and long-term plans could still be met.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Rick, one of the things we learned yesterday is that the lottery bonding, although lottery revenues have been growing, and so it doesn't appear to be the volatility that there is in our income tax revenue, but there is potential volatility with the lottery, and because of that, the rating agencies have a wide spread in terms of how they rate lottery bonds, from AAA all the way down to, I think, single A. And I just wondered, if you had any advice in terms of the potential volatility of lottery revenues, or if you felt very comfortable that those revenues would continue to be strong.
Well, I can't give you a crystal ball any more than what we are given in terms of those projected revenues. However, the lottery bonding capacity, the recommendation, is treated differently than, again, the general fund tax supported bonding. And the commission utilizes what is considered the legal limit of a four times ratio of unencumbered lottery dollars. And as you know, even though we have a lot of growth in the lottery, those dollars are becoming more and more encumbered all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that requirement is designed again, I think, as a governor from our maybe willingness or unbridled enthusiasm to look at lottery money as something that's always going to grow, and we can bond whatever, and it is going to have this tremendous growth by having that significant cap test on it. But again, I think that's part of our responsibility is to look at the fact that we've had these great growth in lottery projections, but that line doesn't go straight up, and you know, trees don't grow to the sky, and we have to make sure that we don't overly commit that. And again, we have so much of our lottery dollars that are now committed, and we have discussed as a body trying to commit some more of those to rainy day funds and others. Mm-hmm. And any time that we overdo ourselves in bonding for long term debt service, it's going to take away our ability to do that.
One other question. So, say that the September forecast, or let's even say December forecast of this year, comes with some troubling news, 10% drop in estimates. Then does the treasurer, but also say that we have passed 5516 almost intact? All of the projects, and we'll get nods of approval here in the audience to this. Most all of the projects, if not all of them, have been approved. What discretion does the treasurer then have in terms of, troubling news in the December forecast, or at least concerning news in the December forecast? We're now right up against 5% or even exceeding that 5%. What discretion would he or she have in terms of approving some, all, or none of the projects that the legislature had already put into play?
Chair Deckard, I believe that the treasurer would have a great degree of discretion relative to that. I would, I cannot speak for the treasurer, of course, but again, with the six-year forecast, there might be the decision to issue some now, knowing that likely capacity might rebound in the two biennia out. But that would be totally up to the discretion of the treasurer whether he or she wanted to reduce the size of a particular bond sale, cancel it completely, or go forward as approved.
And my understanding is on the OHSU, that actually took place, is that bond sales were delayed on the OHSU opportunity to navigate those waters of revenue.
I know that has happened in recent memory with some ballot initiatives that were on the agenda, that the treasurer delayed some bond sales. I was not in this position at the time of the OHSU bond sale, so I don't recall.
Right. Senator George.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here when you guys first began, but we had a couple numbers presented to us yesterday, and between general fund and lottery, the governor chose a number of $1.154 billion, and the maximum capacity we had available was just about $1.3 billion. If I understood you two right, you would prefer, particularly Senator, to stay on the more conservative side with the governor or even below the governor's record?
I can't tell you much about what the governor has done in terms of how this sits with the report, so I'm just going to talk about the report. And if you'll notice in the report that on the lottery side, the recommendation is to stay on the smaller side in the next biennia in terms of looking at the six-year forecast. And you have the ability to grow greater, but again, the prudent case would be to, for the 07-09 biennia, to not to overweight that in terms of the lottery.
And if I may add, Chair Decker, Senator George. The governor's recommended budget for lottery bonding is $443 million, so that is less than the commission's maximum recommendation of $486 million. It is about less than half of the total debt capacity out there. So I think what you might be referring to, too, is as revenue forecasts are released, those numbers do change. So I think what you were probably referring to was the governor's budget was initially included numbers from the September forecast, and when Senator Metzger and the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission released the final reports for the legislature's consideration, it was based on the December forecast, which was slightly higher.
It appears, looking at the numbers, that what the governor did is he's coming in slightly above the estimated 10% potential decline. So he is above what would be considered prudent by our experts. He's below that, but he's slightly above a 10% decline number. So it appeared to be a pretty responsible number to me that the governor used in establishing what he would agree to from both general fund supported and also lottery-backed bonds.
Senators, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Pernsteiner and Mr.
Simonton
are going to, please come up, are going to, Dr. Ray, are you joining them or? You're more than welcome. They are going to walk us through the other half of the equation, the projects that will benefit the economy and why prudent bonding makes sense to grow your revenue stream. Our team from higher education.
Thank you, Senator Decker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Pernsteiner of the Oregon University System. I'm joined today by Bob Simonton, who is the Director of Capital Projects for OUS, and by Ed Ray, who's the President of Oregon State University, which is one of our larger, as you know, one of our larger universities in this state. You have just had a discussion about the debt capacity of the state and the prudent use of that debt capacity. What I want to talk about is why it is a prudent investment for the state to invest in the higher education projects that are in the governor's recommended budget. This discussion will be about Oregon's future. It will be about Oregon's prosperity. And it will be about Oregon's competitive position in a global economy. These projects, as they are proposed, have three sets, really, of important returns on the investment which you are making. Our capital budget includes 46 projects, which total nearly $600 million, bless you, of which about $300 million is supported by...
Just going to dim the lights. Oh, I'm not sure if we have this handout, so we're going to follow you on the screen.
Okay. Thank you.
Or if we have it, I can't find it. The community colleges have done a good job of inundating us with more projects than we knew existed. Here it is, folks.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt you, George.
No, thank you, Senator. We have 46 projects which total nearly $600 million, of which about half, about $300 million, would be supported by state bonds. The other half is supported by a variety of sources. And so one of the points to be made here is one of leverage. In fact, what we're looking at is large numbers of donor dollars that have gone into higher education construction. Since 1995, the $420 million which you have invested in the last six biennia in higher education projects have been matched by nearly $800 million of other people's money. So, in fact, we've gotten over that period of time a very significant return on your investment.
George, can you repeat those numbers?
Yes, in from 95 through 07, the 12 years of that six biennial period, the state, through capital repair, deferred maintenance, new construction, bonds of various kinds, appropriations of various kinds, has contributed $420 million to higher education projects. that has leveraged another $796 million, or almost $800 million, of funding from a variety of other sources. The state bonds that we are requesting in this particular budget, approximately $300 million, are about half, again, the capital budget that we are proposing this time. So that you can look at it in terms of creating jobs in the economy for construction as the first return on investment. If the standard rule of thumb in the industry is that 9 jobs are created per $1 million of construction spending, you're looking at about 5,400 jobs being created by the approval of these projects. The investment of the roughly $300 million of state bonds will leverage then, help leverage, about $300 million of other people's money. The other people are donors, they're the federal government, they're local government, they're student fees, there are a variety of sources which are available to us. But it is very important for our education in general facilities, those facilities in which we teach and in which we conduct our research, that the state, which is the prime, I say, beneficiary of higher education services in this state, plays a very catalytic role in allowing those facilities to be constructed and maintained. There is a very high impact on the Oregon economy for every dollar that the state has spent in education and research. And I will note that here because these facilities will allow us either to continue to educate students and conduct research, or in fact to add to the research capacity which our system will have. You all heard the Onami examples. The Onami example where $1 million in 2003 leveraged $19 million of other people's money for research. And that is being played out again and again throughout the enterprise of our research institutions. This current year, we will receive in federal grants and private grants for research about as much money to conduct research in this state as we will receive from the state to educate 81,000 students. Almost all of that research money comes from external sources. Virtually none of it is from the state, and not too much of it really is Oregon-based to begin with. This is money coming from the outside. Many of the facilities, which you will see as we unfold this capital budget, are related directly to increasing our research capacity in this state, to building on what has become the 7th most productive faculty in America in getting federal grants on a faculty member by faculty member basis. Our faculty are good enough, smart enough, competitive enough to compete with the best in the country. But in order for them to be able to do that, in order for them to be able to provide students with the opportunity to participate in that research, and in order for them to be able to bring to Oregon the tremendous economic effects that that research will bring both immediately and in the future, we need to invest in the facilities in which they will conduct this research. You can look, too, at the education portion of this, where it has been demonstrated, and it's in Portland State's economic impacts survey on the very last page, if you happen to have that. I don't happen to have one in front of me, but if you have it back in your office, look on the last page. The 25% of our adult workforce with a college degree pays 55% of our income taxes. We have, and I have in this room and in other rooms over this session, noted that the education level of young Oregonians is lower than that of their parents. The education level in terms of post-secondary attainment
of young Oregonians in the workforce is less than that of all of us in this room and our generations. In the 21st century, that is not a formula for success. In the 21st century, that is not a formula for success for a state that's dependent upon the income tax to the extent that we are. We need, for the benefit of the citizens, we need, for the benefit of the state, to generate more college degrees, not fewer, and to be able to do that, we need to have facilities that are adequate to the conduct of instruction. As we look at the projects before us, we are proposing to you about $300 million of state bonds, lottery bonds, 11G bonds, and some of the SELP loans. What we are saying is we will bring donor dollars and federal and local match dollars of more than $135 million just for those projects. We are also looking at deferred maintenance. As you know, we have a $640 million backlog of deferred maintenance in our facilities. Many of you have toured these facilities. Lincoln Hall, as you will recall, we inherited Lincoln Hall as Portland State's first downtown building. Do you know why we inherited it? The Portland School District abandoned it in 1952 as unfixable. We have not fixed it. We are 55 years on. This project, finally, is proposed to you by the governor as an important project for the 07-09 biennium. We have similar issues with University of Oregon's Fenton Hall, with Inlow Hall at Eastern Oregon University, with Nash Hall, a science building at Oregon State, with Western's Humanity and Social Science building, and with PSU's Science 2 building, which I'm going to return to in a minute. What we have done over the last 15 years is to neglect our buildings in order to teach our students. The Dew Bill has come. The Fram oil filter ad comes true at some point, and the point is now. If you look at the capital repairs which we are proposing, in Neuberger Hall, where I teach, and hear student complaints almost every time I teach, with regard to that facility, which also includes, in one of the largest classroom buildings in this state, a kiln on the second floor that has raised questions about safety that will be addressed in this particular budget. We have a leaky roof at Gilbert Hall at the University of Oregon campus. And, of course, the ventilation system of Straub Hall has not been improved since it was built in 1925. But I want to turn, really, to the new construction projects and renovation projects, which I think will provide us with the kind of opportunities that really will give the payoff for this state. The first is Science Building Number 2 at Portland State University, which is a combination of deferred maintenance, capital repair, and renovation. We have the opportunity to take over some space that another state agency has vacated, to turn that into science labs in this building. You all heard that Portland State University has grown substantially in the last dozen years. What you may not have heard is that in just the last seven, enrollment in the sciences, credit enrollment in the sciences, has gone up by 54% at PSU. And when you stop to think about what is the challenge for our society in the 21st century, we emphasize science, technology, engineering, and mathematics as disciplines that we worry we will not have enough students taking. We will not have enough people adept at. And yet we're seeing a 54% increase in science enrollment at PSU. And yet the science facilities at PSU are perhaps some of the worst at any level of education in this state. Donor dollars are bringing in more than $9 million. There will hopefully be federal and local dollars as well to help leverage the state's investment of $9 million plus deferred maintenance to actually provide PSU with the kind of labs it will need to teach that 54% more students and growing. But also at the same time, PSU has doubled its research in the last 7 years. Much of it in the sciences and engineering has hired new faculty who are competing at the national level, successfully competing at the national level for grants, and they need places in which to do that research. Research that they often collaborate with faculty at OSU, at U of O, and at OHSU, if I can get the letters out, in order to provide. The Integrated Science Building at the University of Oregon, last session you approved Phase 1 as part of the ONAMI. It's all underground. This session, in fact, the Integrated Science Building, the brain-biology-machine interface effort of the University of Oregon, which is the best in the world at what they do, is proposed for a building. $30 million of donor money will be proposed. More than $20 million of it is already in hand. Those dollars came from out of Oregon. This is not an Oregon donor, but it is a donor who believes so deeply in the research conducted by the University of Oregon and in the promise that the University of Oregon is bringing to the whole world through its research, that he is willing to invest this kind of money at a facility here if only the state will match those dollars to build a building that will allow us to continue an upward trajectory of research and instruction that will permit us in the 21st century to be successful for this state. We're looking at the Linus Pauling Institute at Oregon State University. I think Ed Ray will be able to provide you information. This is even more donor dollars at $31.25 million than the one at the University of Oregon. And this, too, is focused on science and chemistry and a variety of other disciplines that will allow OSU to get additional instruction for students, additional research grants, and, in fact, they're hoping to secure funds to even help operate the building from private sources. But it is important that the state match that effort in the construction, and that's what is proposed. And finally, the last project I'll mention, not because it's the last worthy project, but because I'll run out of time, is the OIT Health Professions Building. You all know the healthcare workforce shortage in this state. You all know that some of the best programs for educating health technologists in the country are offered at the Oregon Institute of Technology. And you all know that they've already received $11 million donor dollars in Klamath Falls to match a $9 million state investment to build this facility. The debt service for the state, if all of our bonds are approved, is about $24 million a year in 2009-11. For that, the state will build more than 500,000 square feet of new, mostly science space, which is the most expensive and, I would argue, the most productive in terms of economic development space we can have. You will renovate and keep in production for future generations more than 600,000 square feet of space in a variety of buildings. In order to allow our very productive faculty and our very talented students an opportunity for research, an opportunity for discovery, an opportunity for learning. This is about building productive capacity for Oregon. Capacity to build an educated workforce, capacity to build a workforce that will pay higher taxes, capacity to conduct research, mostly with other people's money, that will pay dividends for Oregon for a long time to come. And that concludes what I would say, but perhaps President Ray, who has one of the biggest projects here, would like to add.
Thank you, Chancellor. That was an impressive, cogent defense of these projects, about as impressive as I've heard to date.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chancellor. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University. I apologize for not having materials to distribute to you, but I did want to speak to the issue of the capital investment that the Chancellor has already talked about with perhaps some specific content. I chuckled when the Chancellor said perhaps I would have something to say because I was expecting him to say that I always have something to say, so he was pretty sure I'd have something to say. I want to talk just very briefly about three aspects of the investment in capital and higher education. The first, the Chancellor's talked about leveraging private capital dollars. The second, investment investment in research facilities, and finally, the investment in teaching and research capabilities, and how they all represent investment aspects of capital spending. With respect to leveraging private capital dollars, the element that I would add to the obvious that we in all of these new projects are looking for matches to private dollars, so that we're looking for at least an equal amount of private dollars being attracted by the ability of the state to provide funding for capital projects. For us, there's an added particular significance, and I think this is not unusual for universities. We're in a not-so-secret, quiet phase of our first university-wide fundraising campaign. We expect to have a kickoff at the end of this before the end of this calendar year. And part of what gives us momentum going into a successful campaign, as with any campaign, is the kind of total and the kinds of support that we can announce at the outset to get people who genuinely care about the university, care about higher education, to sort of get on board and support us in lots of ways. Obviously, capital projects, but actually that's always a very small part of a university-wide campaign. Most of the money goes into scholarships for students, fellowships for graduate students, professorships, name chairs, equipment, other kinds of operating and discretionary funds. Anything that we can do to increase the total that we're able to announce going forward at the time that we launch that campaign is going to help us in the overall success of that campaign. So to the extent we're now, in fact, talking to a potential donor about the Linus Pauling Institute, part of the attraction to them in considering such a large gift is the hope that the state will, in fact, be able to do a match. And, in effect, they leverage their dollars while the state is leveraging its dollars. It's a win-win. To the extent we're able to be successful with that donor in bringing in $30 million toward our campaign total that we can announce in late October, that's going to create that much more buzz and excitement about the campaign itself. And I guarantee you it'll turn into dollars that we might not otherwise raise, and not even just for capital projects, but for scholarships and all of the other things that I mentioned are part of a university-wide campaign. With respect to the second aspect, investment in research facilities, the Chancellor already spoke with, I think, appropriate passion about our extraordinary colleagues and the work that they're doing to bring in research dollars. But let me give you some examples from Oregon State University, and I know my presidential colleagues could make similar observations for their own institutions about just how extraordinarily well our colleagues have been performing. We're not just talking about heroic efforts. We're talking about performance that is of national stature and significance. Last year in 2005-2006, we had research grants and contracts expenditures totaling $194 million. To help you put that in context, as part of our own strategic planning effort, we've identified our aspirational peers. We talk about a goal of wanting to be among the top 10 land-grant universities in America, and the peers that we choose to measure ourselves against include such institutions as the University of California, Davis, the University of Wisconsin, Texas A&M, Purdue, Penn State University, and others. Obviously an extraordinary group of universities. But let me give you some statistics that actually pleasantly surprised me when I looked at them. The first figure, and this is again for last year's total, if you look at the number of dollars raised per faculty, tenure-track faculty, FTE, among our aspirational peers, the schools we already consider among the top 10 land-grant universities in America, the dollars brought in per faculty tenure-track FTE in the peers is $205,000 per faculty member for the peers. For Oregon State University, it's $222,000 per faculty FTE. If you look at grants and contracts dollars brought in relative to each dollar of state support for those peer institutions, they bring in 97 cents on the dollar. For every dollar of state aid they get, they bring in 97 cents. Oregon State University brings in $1.15 for every dollar of state aid. So as the chancellor was saying, not only are our faculty doing heroic things in tough circumstances, but they're meeting and beating the competition. And when the competition is defined as a number of extraordinary institutions. The other piece of information that I would offer in terms of context is you may be familiar with the National Science Board. This is the essentially the board of advisors to the president on science policy. They're individually appointed by the president of the United States, confirmed by the United States Senate, 24 individuals. They also are, in a sense, the board of directors or board of trustees for the National Science Foundation. They held their one meeting a year that they hold outside of Washington, D.C., at Oregon State University in February. And they were there to see and hear from our students, undergraduates as well as graduates, and faculty about their research projects. I might point out that Jane Lubchenco has been a two-term, and it's the maximum you can serve, a 2 6-year term member of the National Science Board. She has just stepped down. Mark Abbott, our dean of our College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences, was appointed just recently to a 6-year term. Warren Washington, who's a graduate of Oregon State University, just stepped down after serving 2 terms as chair of the National Science Board. And again, these are examples I can give you from Oregon State University. I know that President Frohnmayer, President Bernstein could point to their own evidence of not just that their faculty are doing extraordinarily well, but measured against national standards and measured against extraordinary peers, they're doing very, very well. Finally, with respect to the Linus Pauling Institute, obviously, that project will allow an extraordinarily successful research and teaching enterprise to advance its efforts and its capabilities. But the Linus Pauling Institute is also a very significant player in a couple of other new initiatives that are going on. As I'm sure you know, the Oregon Innovation Council has proposed 2 new signature areas for research and as a follow-on to ONAMI, other areas where the state could distinguish itself. One is in translational research and dealing with infectious diseases. The Linus Pauling Institute will be a major player from Oregon State University in that statewide effort. We've also announced recently a collaboration, as the University of Oregon has, working with OHSU in preparing more medical students for medical careers. The Linus Pauling Institute will be an important programmatic part of our effort to prepare medical students in collaboration with OHSU and others around the state. So again, it's not just about a building. It's not just about the return on investment through research dollars. It's also a matter of how we connect with other important parts of higher education in the state to provide a number of services for the state. The last thing I'll mention is at Oregon State University, we've made a commitment last year, and we're pursuing it now, that much of our renovation work will go, obviously, to some extent, into research facilities that certainly need to be modernized if we're to be able to compete effectively nationally, but also into classrooms and teaching environments. And I like to tell people that our graduates are the most important contribution we make to the future. I honestly believe that. We want them to be prepared to compete with anybody, anywhere. And I think we're doing an effective job at that. But obviously, having classrooms that really have the most contemporary technology and teaching capabilities, in both in the physical environment and obviously through the instructors and their capabilities, will guarantee that we're able to deliver on that promise that they can compete with anyone anywhere. And not only will they be our most important contribution to the future, they will be a profound contribution into the future, not just for the university, but for all of the people of Oregon. So those, again, would be my observations on those three aspects of how capital projects in higher education can really provide substantial long-term benefits for the state. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. Questions for the chair? We have a new senator. welcome. Senator Starr has someone job shadowing him today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex Tomlinson is job shadowing me today, so I thought I'd have an opportunity to listen to the committee meeting.
Thank you for welcome, Alex. Questions for the chancellor or for President Ray? Recruitment of faculty. This is a bit of a softball, but how critical is it in terms of facilities? And I guess a better question would be faculty lost due to inadequate facilities. I know it would be anecdotal, but I'm not sure it's happened.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not only anecdotal. I think all of us can understand that there are a lot of things that attract faculty to positions at particular universities. Probably first and foremost are the colleagues that they'll have to work with, the students they'll be able to help learn and maybe welcome as colleagues in their profession later on. Facilities are a very important part of the decision process because the capabilities that they'll have to do cutting-edge research and really make profound contributions themselves will be tremendously affected by the kinds of facilities and equipment they have, as I said, the colleagues and students. We talk about compensation a lot. Compensation matters. That's a margin along which other universities compete with us to attract some of our best and brightest away from us. But part of what allows us to resist those temptations, and I think you've heard the chancellor on other occasions speak about the fact that our faculty on average are paid something like 86% of the average of their peer institutions. Well, one of the reasons we're able to keep them here is because of the colleagues they have to work with, the students, the commitment they have to the research that they're doing, and the more contemporary the facilities and equipment they have to work with, the more profound the contributions are that they're going to make. It's not only anecdotal, though. I can tell you that the small animal research facility and hospital connected with the College of Veterinary Medicine was completed a couple of years ago, and I can tell you, because I've gotten testimony from colleagues from my former life in the area of veterinary medicine, that Oregon State University's College of Veterinary Medicine is one of the places that the whole profession is watching, because they have in fact made extraordinary hires of key faculty over the last several years, and when I talk to those faculty about the things that helped attract them here, they talked about the quality of the facilities for research and for treatment and care of animals that they saw being put in place at Oregon State University. So it can be a tremendous magnet to bring people here and certainly to keep them here once they're here.
The Kelly Engineering School, do you know, did the state contribution precede Mr. Kelly's very generous contribution to that project, or was it...
Well, the chancellor, I wasn't here at the time. I can tell you some funny stories about it. I know that the commitment was made. And in fact, my understanding, and if you know Martin Kelly, this is totally believable, that Martin Kelly did not want to be publicly recognized for making that extraordinary contribution to building a new facility for electrical and electrical engineering and computer sciences. And it was in the hearings when the question was raised about, well, how do we know the money's there? Who's this donor? That he actually stepped forward. But the commitment was already made by him. But again, I'm sure the discussion was along the lines that we can leverage if you can make this contribution, we can go to the legislature in good faith and leverage those dollars into a project that is even more extraordinary than we could accomplish without your support or only with your support. So I know it it made a difference in his thinking about the gift.
One other, and this is somewhat of a minor question. Do you know offhand, you mentioned the peer institutions and faculty research.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if those figures were a composite or an average?
Yeah, that was their average figure. So when I was talking about the $205,000 per tenure track faculty FTE, that was the average of the 10 institutions.
Versus OSU's
figure for that year. And the same with the 97 cents on the dollar state support was their average for the 10 institutions versus the figure for OSU.
It's very impressive.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, it's not just that, and it's hard to get this across, it's not just that they're doing incredibly well given the circumstances they're in. It's that in any absolute sense, they are doing extraordinarily well. They measure up nationally and internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true for the system, which is something we feel really proud about.
Yeah, I don't think most Oregonians, that's a statistic that bears repeating many times because I don't think most Oregonians, even well-informed or hopefully well-informed ones, have that on the tip of their tongue. So I'm glad you brought it to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Really appreciate the testimony.
I just thought the ducks were impressive.
That's right. That's right.
They are.
Community colleges. Senator Mona Anderson is here. Good. Would you like to be accompanied, or you'll lead off with the dash ones? And
the president can be with me. Even though he testified yesterday, he doesn't need to testify, but just in case.
He's very, he's high in demand, President of Mount Hood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monas Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. That's Senate District 25. And I'm very excited about Senate Bill 5516. And just to give you some history, Representative Lim and I were very concerned that Mount Hood was off of the prioritized list, so we had both submitted House Bill 2501 and Senate Bill 472 because we were extremely concerned that Mount Hood Community College had not gotten on the governor's list. When you take a look at the Community College Capital Construction Rank Order list, Mount Hood was actually number 4 on that list, but for some reason was left out. So therefore, I am definitely in favor of the Dash 1 amendments to this bill also. We truly need a substantial investment in the Oregon Community College capital construction. Mount Hood Community College has never passed a bond since it was built. We are in a conservative part. We love our community college, but for some reason the voters just don't want to pay. They want the community college, but they don't like to pass bonds. What the $2.5 million for the community college, for Mount Hood Community College, would actually be used for the Child Development Center. And the facility housing the Mount Hood Community College Child Development Center is a 30-year-old modular building, and it's safe, but it's definitely a substandard environment for our children. And was this passed out? This was the Mount Hood Community College Child Development Center analysis of children and families served. And take a look at the number of children that they serve, 88. And out of those, 67 of the 88 are children of students. And then look, 40 of the 88 are actually Head Start children. And I know that's a goal here in the legislature to fund all Head Start programs. But we truly have a very long waiting list. And we definitely need to have our Mountain Hood Community College Child Development Center built. And so that's pretty much what I wanted to say. And I'm definitely encourage you to pass the dash ones. Please remember to take a look at the community college rank order list. We are number 4, and if there are others that think they want to be on the list, well, hopefully they can be included too. But if not, just remember that the dash one amendments are. All right, and that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson. Okay. Thank you for safeguarding Senator Mona Sanderson. If anything,
I'm just here to carry the water. That's all.
You have legislators who love your institution. One seated, two to my right.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Deckert, and members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cam, can I ask you a question about the dash ones? And other folks obviously have questions for Ms. Forrest-Briley. How did this come about, the dash ones within the community college process that y'all use, and how does this fit into the governor's budget and the balanced budget on the operating side and the capital request that was put in?
Thank you, Chair Deckert. For the record, Cam Preuss-Briley, Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. We did propose a ranked order list that was submitted with our agency request. The governor's budget, when it appeared and when it was published in December, three of the projects had been removed from the list. So the dash ones, as you have, I think, surmised, adds those three colleges back in. The approved projects, I guess the debt service and the overall projects went from $108 million to $87 million. In the governor's budget from the request, and the debt service, see if I can, is, let's see, it's $25 million, and that includes, that would be for 09-11 debt service, which would include those that we're going to sell bonds for in approximately a month. So it would, including Mount Hood, Chemeketa, and Klamath, the total would be $21,203,000.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I can give you a little bit more in the background of what happened with Mount Hood Community College. Prior to the November bond election, we had a project on the list for $16 million, and we were planning on doing the match out of our bond that failed. I think the governor took a look at that project and the fact that our match money via the bond had failed and took us off the list. What has happened since that time, of course, is that we've scaled back our need to the highest priority on the campus, which is the Child Care Child Development Center, which is a total of a $5 million project, so we're only asking for $2.5 million, and we have identified the match for that. And so I understand what the governor did. I'm not being critical, but it is very important that we get that Child Development Center, that much scaled back project, back on the list and have it funded. Does that help?
That does. What is the nature of the match?
The match comes from a number of sources. We're working, Earl Blumenauer's office is working on getting us some federal grant money. We have a very well-heeled foundation with several prominent business leaders. The foundation has pledged to raise money. The board has identified additional money from our normal savings and so on that we could put in if necessary. So we will meet the match, the $2.5 million match.
And is that the Senator Monroe spoke to the rationale for removing those projects when your office was working on this? Is that basically the rationale of why some projects were removed from the rank order, not just the Mount Hood Community College one?
Chair Deckert, the department was not in the negotiation with the governor's office. We submitted our list of 14 projects, I'm sorry, and when the governor's budget was published, it had 12. So we were not a party to that negotiation. It is after the fact that we learned some of what Senator Monroe has described.
Great.
And I need to correct the record. I was reading the Article 11G bond totals was confusing it with debt service. Which piece of information would you like so that I give you what you wanted?
What I was following you on, certainly we kind of called you out of order, so we understand shuffling papers and getting numbers is difficult. The debt service, the numbers that I was jotting down, and folks jump in here, was $25 million with the Dash 1 projects included, 21 something, and I just didn't catch the number, million in 09-11 without the Dash 1s. Projects included.
Well, let me, since I now have it in front of me,
yeah.
And I can certainly provide this sheet to the committee, Mr. Chair. The total of debt service for 09-11, including projects from 2005-07, is $18,255,000. If we add the debt service for the three that are not in the governor's budget, that brings it up to just under or just over $20 million in debt service in 09-11. So from 18 to 20.
The increase, Mr. Chair, is about $17 million in total for the projects. the new projects that are in the Dash 1 amendment. That translates to about $1.5 million payments per year.
Other questions for Ms. Sprawley? Thank you.
Thank you.
If there's someone from the governor's office at some point that would like to speak to the Dash 1s, that would be helpful. I'm scanning the room with my poor eyes. I don't see them. So we'll go right. We'll get back on to the list if I can.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have spoken to Mr. Sager of the governor's office, and he said the governor would be very supportive if we could get our project back on the list. So he didn't give me any cold water at all.
Okay, that's good to know. So Mr. Sager, who was here yesterday, and you spoke specifically about the projects.
I absolutely did. I spoke about the Mount Hood project.
In particular.
Yeah.
Which is a large part of that, the 17, or a decent part of the 17. Okay, I'm assuming we've got Mondays, so we'll start with Pat O'Connor from our coast, Joanne Truesdell, and Sonia Christensen from Lane Community College. Thank you for your patience as we do a three-part process here of higher ed, community college, and then really the key question for us, which is the level of debt service the state can afford.
Certainly.
Good morning. Chair Deckert, members of the committee. My name is Pat O'Connor, president of Oregon Coast Community College. Oregon Coast Community College is a small rural community college serving Lincoln County on the central Oregon coast. And our classes are held currently predominantly in a former bar, former karate studio, and a former fire station. But that is all going to change by virtue of the actions of Lincoln County voters that passed a bond measure in May 2004. Most of the requested $7.5 million match from the state is for the construction of an aquarium science building. This is a joint-use facility between Oregon Coast Community College and the Hatford Marine Science Center of Oregon State University. I provided the committee with a picture of the facility as well as a DVD.
Uh-huh.
No, you don't have much spare time, but just wanted to make sure you knew about that. So this is a very good program. Why is this request a prudent investment by the state of Oregon? Well, I can think of at least three reasons. First of all, it's a coordinated project between various public and private partners including Oregon Coast Community College, Oregon State University, the Oregon Coast Aquarium, which is a tremendously powerful force on the Oregon coast, as well as other private and public entities being served to the Hatfield Marine Science Center. It's almost an alphabet soup of federal state agencies that are being served on that campus. This building is noted in OSU's facility master plan. We were very fortunate last night at the Community College Board meeting to have Dr. George Bollert, who's the Executive Director of the Hatfield Marine Science Center, do his presentation. It was very compelling. The second reason is that not only does this project help diversify our local workforce, but also it's directly tied to Oregon's economic development in the areas of aquarium science and marine sciences, as well as some new initiatives such as wave energy that you've heard about previously. The first floor of this facility will be dedicated to instruction of aquarium science, marine sciences. Second floor for research for Oregon Fish and Wildlife, as well as Hatfield Marine Science Center's OSU Center. So there's a partnership there. The third that I mentioned before briefly is that the college has the match money in hand. Okay, we passed the $23.5 million bond measure for the first permanent classroom facilities, and construction is currently underway in our other areas. Despite hard economic times, local voters placed a priority on education and workforce development in the county, and that's something that we're very proud of. What we do need is participation by the state of Oregon to maximize this partnership that we have with Oregon State University and other entities. We're also working on another partnership with the center in Charleston with the University of Oregon for what's called the COSI project on ocean literacy. Essentially, it makes good business sense. In closing, the state has an opportunity to invest in a project that will yield benefits for years to come. One of the recommendations from last summer's conference in Washington, D.C. on ocean literacy notes the crucial role the community colleges will play in, quote, developing programs to improve ocean literacy and to generate innovative workforce with the diversity in mind. Here's a great place to invest in Oregon's future. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to listen to me this morning, and would like to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Questions for Mr. O'Connor? It says the match is in hand for the second floor.
The match is in hand, yes, for the first floor, excuse me.
For the first floor.
Right. What we're trying to do is put on the second floor of the building. This will also help complement the master plan of the Hatfield Marine Science Center to have two-story buildings on campus. It will also help with the sustainability by generating income revenue for operating the building. There is also a lack of space for research on that campus.
So the state funding would be the second floor.
Correct.
Of the building, and you have the first floor. You've parsed this out in the budget, and the first floor is paid for, or the money is
essentially. It's currently not very feasible to have a one-story building to run the operation. So that was the idea of trying to maximize that footprint on the OSU campus.
Senator George.
Hope the voice works. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
This is going to be in addition to the existing facilities already there. Is this a replacement for them?
This will be a new facility.
This is addition.
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I serve and have the pleasure of serving as interim president of Clackamas Community College. I understand that we've inundated you with papers, so I'd like to just quickly identify the pieces of paper that I provided you. You have a PowerPoint that shows a picture of the Clackamas Community College Harmony campus as of 2007 and a rendering of the proposed project. And you also have what's called the Clackamas County Hospital Economic Profile. And then a yellow sheet that is the vision of the Nursing and Allied Healthcare Center of Excellence. And you also have a letter from me, which I'd like to go over with you. I'm here today to address your concerns relating to the future revenue and the ability of the state to service debt associated with the community college project's capital construction. The Clackamas Healthcare Blue Ribbon Committee, the BRC, and is an industry-led coalition that was developed in 2005 to analyze the following kinds of activity. First, it needed to validate whether or not health care was an economic engine for our area and for our state. It also was made available to develop a long-term strategy for sustaining the health care cluster. The BRC made the following recommendations: to solve a critical workforce education and training for today's healthcare industry partners, strategically locate healthcare training and education center, support the continued expansion and success of the healthcare cluster in Clackamas County by providing family wage jobs for Oregon residents. The documents provided to you today address the BRC recommendations. However, since the central issue today is about economic growth and the ability to fund the debt, the information provided in the document entitled Clackamas County Hospital Economic Profile is the most relevant. This study was an exhaustive study. It looked at the future impact to healthcare in that region. The profile was directed through the leadership of the Clackamas County Economic Development Healthcare Committee, and the membership is listed on page 21 of that document if you'd like to see the different individuals. The economic multipliers that are in play in the development and implementation of Clackamas Community College's capital construction project includes the construction and operation of the facility, as well as the effects of the hospital industry on the local economy. Again, this is a partnership. Clackamas Community College project is priority number 3, as ranked on your list that was provided earlier by the Oregon President and submitted to the State Board of Education, moved forward to the governor's recommended budget as well. Okay, so let's go on to the multipliers, because those are the most important pieces that you're after. Construction of the facility. An income multiplier of 1.5 for every dollar spent, an additional $1.5 comes back into the economy just by virtue of construction of that facility. The total cost of the facility is going to be $20 million, of which a portion will be state match, a portion will be college-committed certificates of participation, and a large substantial portion will be through foundation and grant activity that the community college, Clackamas Community College Foundation, is currently underway with. So with that, $20 million investment brings, just by virtue of the construction, about $10,500 additional into the local area. When we look at the job creation multiplier of capital construction projects, that's about 1.66. And that 1.66 is simply for every one construction-related position that's created in this project, an additional 0.66 is created in the support of that capital construction project. So just during the time that facility is being constructed. In terms of the operation of the facility, in 2006, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development contracted with Community College Benefits, or CC Benefits, to conduct an economic impact study for each of the community colleges. For Clackamas Community College, the results of that survey indicate that for every $1 investment in total public resources, both state and local taxes, that Clackamas Community College returns today $5.80. So in both just the construction of the facility and the general operations of the facility, you can see that this is a wise investment. But let's not stop there, because it is important that we take a look at who is it that we are serving by strategically locating in that area. As I mentioned, the BRC strongly recommended and supports and continues to support through this economic study that the facility, our campus at Harmony, be redeveloped into an allied healthcare center of excellence. And for the hospital cluster, the economic multipliers are high. High economic multipliers are estimated to be between 2.63 and 2.69% of wages generated by the urban hospitals. We have 5 located within about a mile of that facility. Five hospitals.
Within how close?
About a mile of that facility. In your PowerPoint presentation packet on the third slide, you will see all the healthcare clusters that are surrounding that facility.
So all these red dots are healthcare that we're looking at that same.
Yes.
They are all, that's remarkable. All institutions of healthcare are the facility.
It is a very large, not only hospital-oriented, but with the hospital in a cluster environment, you have other facilities. You have the outpatient care. You have specialists. And you have providers, manufacturing providers, who are manufacturing goods for the hospital at that point, food service providers, you name it. It's an industry. It's a cluster, an economic cluster. So with that, if you're thinking then about those other related facilities that support the local hospitals, those economic multipliers are between 2 and 2.63 for every dollar invested. With hospitals bring the federally funded payments in the form of Medicare and Medicaid, and as I was sitting in the back row a little bit earlier, I realized today that, yes, in about 5 minutes, I will be older than I was 5 minutes previous. And while I enjoy that benefit immensely, eventually I will need a different type of care. And so with that, with the increase in aging population, the federal dollars spent on health care in that area also increase. This creates a multiplier effect of 2, and this particular study that identified the multiplier effect of 2 was done using a little bit more rural hospital area than what North County is. But when Kogan Owens Kogan looked at that multiplier effect and how we serve a number of rural patrons in that area, it seemed to hold. So according to that profile of the $2 just in federally funded payments, over about a five-year period of time, $988 million will be generated. So as we look to the future, there'll be $988 million located. It's rapidly expanding in our North County. And our role in providing incumbent worker education, as well as new education for replacement workers, is critical. And that I think as some of the partners that George Pernsteiner mentioned in his presentation, while OIT is working on their Klamath expansion, we are co-located with OIT. They are on the committee as active, and we are simply taking the lead in this effort for this healthcare facility. So with that, I really appreciate the task that you have at hand. And it's very difficult to decide at what level, at what threshold. But my hope is that you have a good understanding about how our project, and I believe how the other projects in the community college system do have the ability to provide that economic engine to keep us moving and to repay that debt. Thank you.
Thank you. It's fair. It is helpful, and it's good to be reminded of the positive stimulus that we get whenever large construction projects occur. Lane Community College.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, I'm Sonia Christian, the Vice President of Instruction and Student Services at Lane Community College in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here on behalf of President Mary Spieldy, who's out of the country right now. I'm here to speak about Lane's health and wellness building that has a $15 million price tag, of which $7.5 million is in the governor's proposed budget. There are two primary purposes for the health and wellness building. The first purpose is to focus on the healthcare professionals, the growing employment need here in Oregon. You heard testimony yesterday about the shortage of nurses in the state of Oregon. In addition to that, in Eugene and Springfield, we have two additional facilities, Peace Health Sacred Heart and the McKenzie Willamette facilities that are being built. You also know about the new hospital in Junction City. So right now at Lane Community College, every year, we have a waiting list of 100 to 200 students for our class size of 56 students that are generally funded. In addition to that, Peace Health sometimes funds an additional cohort or two. Another point to be made is the integration of simulation technology into the nursing curriculum. Our current facility is inadequate. There's no space, and also in terms of the technology infrastructure to support this change in the curriculum. In addition to the integration of simulation technology being good for student learning, there is also a positive economic impact. our faculty are able to take additional students because the simulation technology allows students to practice skills in the context of the college before they venture out into the clinical sites in the hospitals. In addition to nursing, we're also looking at other healthcare areas like RadTech, a medical lab technology program, physical therapy assistant, dental hygiene. And let me speak a little bit about these programs. The Oregon Community Colleges have truly come together and taken in a regional perspective to solving local education needs. For example, if there is a local workforce need in a certain healthcare area, like imaging, for example, rather than a community college approaching it and starting a new program, which is very expensive, the colleges have really collaborated and tried to utilize distance learning to bring the education from a college that already has the program. So two examples, Lynn Benton has a RadTech program, and Lane Community College is partnering with Lynn Benton to bring the RadTech program to our local community. And again, positive economic impact and bringing down the cost for RadTech education. Similarly, Lane Community College has a dental hygiene program, and we just received a $2 million Department of Labor grant. It's a federal grant to partner with Lynn Benton Community College and Umpqua to get our dental hygiene program out in a distance learning mode. The second purpose for the building is really to respond to the aging population. Our long-term care facilities have approached the college to look at two parts of the need. One is the certified nurse assistant program and the second tier of the certified nurse assistant program, as well as the licensed practical nurse program. However, the long-term care health facilities are also looking at wellness programs. At Lane Community College, with a growing insurance cost, what we had incorporated in the last 5 years is a wellness program at the college. So we have a fitness program, a nutrition program, as well as we've expanded our health clinic for our employees beyond just the students. And what we were able to accomplish was really bringing down the insurance costs. So the long-term care providers are taking that approach for the aging population, and so we are partnering in providing fitness training specialists and so on for those facilities. So in conclusion, Chair Deckard, you had asked yesterday about why community colleges, and in addition to the eloquent responses provided yesterday, I want to make a comment from a global perspective. Higher education and the United States in general is talking about India and China and the knowledge workers, particularly engineers and computer scientists who have masters and PhDs, and the location of jobs to Bangalore, India. And I just wanted to point out that there is another phenomenon happening in India, which is the investment in the community college system in India that has started in the last 10 years but really gaining root in the last 5 years. And the Indian government is recognizing the need for providing technicians and technologists, and so that's going to sort of take them into sort of the next strata of economic development. Finally, our foundation board passed in the January board meeting a resolution for a capital campaign to come up with the remaining $7.5 million, and we have our first donor who's made a $1 million contribution. So that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on a $1 million donation. It's not easy to come by every day, so that's very impressive. I assume private donation.
Yes.
Questions for this panel of presidents and vice presidents of their institutions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Going right down the list, Mr. Fred Smith, Mr. Greg Hammond, and if it's doctor, I apologize. Whenever I say doctor, it's not, and if I say Mr., it is. Jim Middleton, Mr. Jim Middleton from Central Oregon Community College. Good morning, and we are now heading towards our hour where all my colleagues leave me. And there goes one. Kudos to these guys. They are, most of them have been very sick, to my colleagues on the dais. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Decker. I'm Fred, for the record, I am Fred Smith. I'm the president of Klamath Community College in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And I'm going to be very, very short and very, very sweet for everybody's purpose. I gave you a number of materials, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of them and give you time to run through those very, very quickly. But what I'm here today for is to support all my colleagues and in general, and then in particular, ask you to support the Dash A amendments. My organization is not looking for handout, it's looking for hand. My institution fell
off. The Dash One
amendments, because my organization had a chance last legislative session for a full campus, and we got a partial for that. We are back on the list. We fell to the bottom of the list. When you fall to the bottom of the list, you generally get clipped off when there's not enough money. So that's part of playing the game. I agreed to it last time. I agree to support my colleagues this time. So please support all the capital and the Dash One amendments. With that stated, I want to point out a few things to you with the documents you have in front of you. The first thing that you should understand is the numbers I will give you will be very small, but sometimes they're very large. For my institution to create a campus, we would probably have to pass a bond measure of around $60 million if we were doing this straight up. That is $1 per thousand of assessed valuation in Klamath County. Does anybody want to give me odds if I can win that puppy? All right. So that's why I need a hand from you folks. With the $7.7 million last session, and perhaps $7.5 if you'll accept the amendments, then I have a fighting chance with my district. But let me talk to you a little bit real quickly about investments in my area, and we'll go from there. If you'll take the document you have in your hand called the Pride Slides, and I want to talk to you a little bit about investment. And if you go to the first page on Pride Slides, my institution is only 10 years of age, and the first slide you see is what we started out in, which is Assembly of God Church. And then if you look at the second page, it is a renovated steel building circa 1960. All right. Then if you go to the third page, you see four pictures, and that is what it looked like before we moved to the east side of town. And then on the next page is what it looks like now. And let me point out to you on the top left, you will see there's a sidewalk because we helped the community widen the highway so it would be safe for us. On the right-hand side, you see how we've modified what is now our Building 3, which makes it look nice. On the bottom left, you can see there's a whole new building that we have invested ourselves. We use our operating capital to create that building. And then to the bottom right is you can see there's a little culvert there and a little road. That's roadway we put in with help from Representative Garrod, and I'll talk to you real quick about that in a few moments. So I'll be real quick. The rest of the slides are just simply before and afters of buildings that we have modified on campus, and you can get to see a feel for, my brother calls me the president of Costco University, and you can understand why he calls me that, because it looks like that. That's the first document. The second document I'm going to run you through really quickly is this three-page document, and we're going through a planning process for the creation of our campus. And on the top of that page, it's not important to see me what looks like I'm teaching people the hokey pokey, because that's what my daughter says those series of pictures look like, or the bottom with the people asking questions. What you need to know is if you look at the background, you see what appears to be a tree with snow on it.
Mm-hmm.
We had 18 inches of snow at minimally in Klamath Falls. We had almost 100 people come out and talk to us about what our community college, as well as our workforce and our economically should be. That's the town was shut down. I mean, it takes a lot to shut down Klamath Falls with snow. And I live on the east side of town, and we didn't get pounded. But there are places in Klamath that had over 30 inches of snow on the ground on that day, and folks came. So that's the first slide. The second slide, this slide, is the investments we have made to this point. If you look at that in the green, that is the 50 acres we plan to build our campus on. You can see a single X and a double X. The double X is a building. It's the only building in this area that we don't own. And the single X is a teasing. Representative Garrard helped us get access to South 6, so that's Garrard Way. And so that's what that is. Last but not least, you talk about partnerships and the need, and we have plenty of partnerships on the docket. And the large circle on the top you see on the left, that is an area where our community would like to have what Chemeketa Community College has, and that is called a functioning training center for the firefighting department. At the bottom, in the large circle, it's another partnership that our community wants us to have, and it's the partnership that Dr. Silverman has talked about with Head Start to create a child care center, not only for child care for our students, but for a learning lab for our education majors. The other two circles, one is for our apprenticeship community, which is at the bottom, and we're hoping to be able to move into that, and the other is at the top, and it's for our Gateway to College program that we'll be partnering with PCC for helping students. These are all things that we hope to have. We have some investments. We learned just last week we had, which is right out of the story of how Stanford was created, an individual has bequeathed their entire estate to us for a recreational area, so that's $570,000 they've given us. We have another anonymous donator for our campus that has told us he wants to build a building, but he doesn't want anybody to know about it until his death. So we have people who are ready to invest. We would hope that the committee would find it important to invest in all of us, support all the capital for all the community colleges, and please add back some of us through the Dash A amendments, Dash 1 amendments. Thank you very much.
Okay, whoever's going to go next, state your name for the record and proceed.
Vice Chair George and members of the committee, my name is Greg Heyman. I'm president of Clatsop Community College. You have three documents, and I'm only going to talk about one of them, so I will be quick. This is what I'm going to talk through, but you also have something I'll call your attention to. There's a great letter from one of our students in here that tells you about why we need this project and why what it will mean to her future, and I encourage you to look at that. Clatsop Community College is a comprehensive community college serving the northwest corner of the state. We're the only provider of post-secondary education in our region. The next closest college is over an hour away, and it is in a different state than ours. We serve 37% of all people between the ages of 15 and 19 every year. 27% of the high school graduates in our county come to Clatsop Community College in the subsequent fall as a degree-seeking student. We contribute $92 million of economic activity to our region annually. Our project is not an expansion. It is not an enhancement. It is a replacement. Our ability to continue to provide that economic vitality to our area and to serve those students is contingent upon our ability to build a new campus. If you need information about why we need a new campus, I would encourage you to look at pages basically starting with this one. They're not numbered. You'll see pictures. You'll be references to accrediting agencies and our own Civil Rights Audit Committee, which has indicated to us that we have sufficient access deficiencies. We have significant infrastructure and structural deficiencies. And it becomes imperative to us that if we are able and if we need and to provide that economic infusion to our community, this campus becomes a part of that future. We're glad to be able to serve our community, and we have served them for 50 years, and we would like to serve them for 50 years more and more than that. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Senator Deckard, Chair Deckard, and committee. I'm Jim Middleton, President of Central Oregon Community College. I'll be mercifully quick for you. All the things that you can say about health care centers apply to the Health and Science Center that is our project. But I do want to take a little bit about what you are leveraging. It's not on your list, but Central Oregon Community College has over $56 million in intended projects that we are working on. The state funds that we are talking about constitute only 13% of that total multiple project list.
Capital?
Yes. To be honest, without the state money, approximately 52% of that, $29 million, would collapse because the state will leverage the local match on bonding, and part of the local match then also allows us to piggyback some other projects also in the outlying areas. In absence of that, that would probably collapse along with 92.7% of my credibility, which is not your problem. The Oregon Employment Department projects a 25% increase from 2004 to 2014 healthcare jobs in Central Oregon. We currently are doing exploration of new programs in med lab tech, veterinary tech, physical therapy, pharmacy technician. We would drop those initiatives of considering new programs. In absence of a new building, there is no room to put them. The sciences are the real key to entrance, not only into health fields, but also many of the growing technology companies within our area. Quickly, I'd just like to highlight a couple of things that are unique about the Central Oregon case. Certainly, you all know about the huge growth within our area. There are specifics about this project. We have been working with the Keck Foundation's Project Kaleidoscope, which are really working with leading scientific university peers across the country to construct facilities that support modern teaching technology and create flexibility. You can ask us what are the programs that we're putting in today, but more importantly, we have to build buildings that will allow us to create the science and health curricula 20 years from now. We need to design facilities with that level of flexibility. We're also partnering with our local community to house the Volunteers in Medicine program, which is a low-cost alternative for health care for individuals without insurance. We run a dental clinic in our facility. It is significantly restricted. We would expand that with our dental assisting program. Also, uniquely, we house the state's only branch campus of Oregon State University, the OSU Cascades facility, which also co-sponsors University of Oregon's science bachelor's degree. So the facility at Central Oregon Community College leverages opportunity not just for our students, but is absolutely critical for students in the OSU Cascades program and for the University of Oregon program, a multiplier effect that is part of the investment that we think is a no-brainer, but really important as we look in the state's fastest-growing region. In respect of your time, I'll answer any questions you have that allow you to move on.
Thank you. Questions for this panel. The $56 million, is that inclusive of the Cascadia campus?
No, those are community college projects. We separately would be working with, we have there's currently one building for the Cascades campus. Our long-term plan has a footprint for four buildings for the university. Those would be separately funded.
And how are you deriving the $56 million that's the non-state?
That is from student fees that we've done, some self-finance for student housing. We have a capital campaign. We also have recently received $1 million gift for one of those facilities. The other would be bonding that we would go out for. We are retiring in 2009, the only bonded indebtedness that we have, so that we would be able to take off the books taxation as we would put the new bond on.
How much is predicated on a bond passing?
I believe we would have a substantially difficult time to pass a bond without the state portion of it.
But what portion of that 56? Sorry to just throw a question.
Of the 56 would be 7.5. So 13, only 13% of the total projects that we are working on are state funded.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. Two more, and as you can see, we're now on the floor, going to the floor. Blaine Nissen and Mr. Jim Sorensen from Treasure Valley. Good morning. Thank you for your patience.
Good morning. Senator Deckert, my name is Blaine Nissen. I serve as the president of Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon. We are the community college for Douglas County, and I am pleased to be with you today to talk about our project that's included in the capital funding request. We work very, very closely with our community to get people back to work in our county that has had traditionally very high unemployment rate. Currently, that unemployment rate is 8.2%. Our capital request is for a regional health occupations building, and it would allow UCC to respond to a variety of training needs in the healthcare industry. We have an exceptionally strong background in healthcare. During this immediate past recession, our community came together, in spite of state funding, to expand our nursing program by 40%. And we currently serve 126 students in our nursing program. And if you put the pencil to that, assuming that each graduate earns approximately $45,000, that's almost a $2 million. That's a $1.6 million additional earnings with that expansion of 16 students in that program. Or, excuse me, 36 students in that program.
Are you at capacity in that program currently?
We are at 126. This year we have over 240 applicants for the first year of the program. So the demand certainly exceeds the capacity of the program. We were able to expand that program, as I say, through lots of community partnerships, including a $1 million donation that helps to pay for two faculty positions in the program. When we look at the needs of Douglas County over the next 7 years, there's a projected shortage of 2,400 health care employees. And so we're looking at a variety of programs that we would propose that we'd look at in offering, including dental assisting, pharmacy technician, home health care assistant, expansion of our registered nursing program, respiratory therapy, all kinds of programs related to health occupations. We feel very comfortable that we'll be able to both raise the money through a capital campaign. We have a $6 million endowment for a foundation that currently employs a half-time director. We're in the process of adding a full-time director and conducting our first capital campaign. And we'd also seek a bond through an election in November of 2008. I know that you're short on time, so I'm trying to make my remarks very quick. We need an investment in Douglas County in this type of project so we can continue to meet the needs of Douglas County in the health care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Deckert, Chair, I am Jim Sorensen for the record, President of Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, Oregon. I'll make it very brief. As president of the Oregon President's Council and this 17 community colleges throughout the state, we as a group of presidents support the 15 projects that we have brought forward. They went through CCWD, the State Board of Education, was recommended to the governor's office, and we do, again, support that full list as the Oregon Community College Association does. Treasure Valley Community College specifically has on the list what we call a Community College University Center, and it really is to enhance the offerings we have with Eastern Oregon University and have had for 25 years. We may not get as much print and press as some institutions do, but this has been going on for many, many years in Eastern Oregon with Blue Mountain ourselves and Eastern, and you're aware of that in the past. We will continue that. We are the only service provider as far as community college within 200 miles of any direction in the area that we serve, and it's an advantage and it's a disadvantage. We as an institution serving that rural area would probably find it next to impossible to do a public vote on a bond measure, but leveraging what the state would provide us, and this is a very modest request of $4.3 million, it's really to replace aging infrastructure and classrooms, specifically lab space that's on campus. We have labs that are about 40 years old, and they are well kept, and we've done a good job with all of the infrastructure of the institution, but this would replace those science labs and help us provide even more healthcare workers for the state. It's even more need on the east side of the state than there is on the west side. So it's an ongoing need. We have a shortage of lab space, particularly in the chemistry area. We have a lab that will hold 15, and we put 24 people in there. So I describe it as being very close proximity to one another when we talk about it. We also have no physical science space on campus. So this would not only replace the biology and the chemistry, but would add some additional labs. It has as part of it a simulation lab for nursing that would be included. We will offer additional programs, not only with Eastern, but working with other community colleges and other institutions in the state, some cooperative ventures in the healthcare arena to do things like radiation technological training, some of the other healthcare areas that are needed. We would do that through interactive delivery and not only have a larger space, and we have a good interactive video delivery on campus that we just built a year or so ago, but we would add additional ones, smaller perhaps, to meet the needs of some of the healthcare. We could possibly place in hospitals three or four workers, such as radiology technicians in our area, but we couldn't handle a lot of that. But we'll try to do a lot more of that for particularly the rural areas of the state. It would also have other general classroom space, which is also needed. The spaces being left would then be remodeled in the general classroom space that we also need. So to make a long story short, we again support all 15 projects. We have a need. This is the first facility that would be added to campus in 40 years. And we made it modest so that we could borrow the money and pay it off as a COP if we couldn't do it locally on a voted election. So we have some money saved up, several hundred thousand already, and we will continue and make this happen if the state's going to invest in our area as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our testimony on 5516. The general statement that I would make, and this is with respect to the contents of what's in Senate Bill 5516 and certainly the -1 amendments, is what I'm hearing, and we'll try to round out this discussion for this committee in the next week or two, hopefully, if not shorter, is to go south in terms of that overall number, and we're really not going to get into it project by project. We are not the proper venue for that discussion, but the general, what I'm hearing is not to move north in terms of the overall number, both on the lottery and the GO side, but to go the opposite direction, and so folks should just factor that, I believe, at least in first steps into their consideration of what's in the bill and then amending the bill to add more projects. With that, I will thank you very much for all the testimony. It was very, very compelling and needed to talk about the positive side in terms of economic growth and revenue for our income-dependent system. Close the public hearing on 5516 and close the public hearing on 152 and adjourn the committee till 8:45 Wednesday.